PBS currently on Nova is doing things like this, and they're doing the one on the research on Richthofen, and there was someone that got to the cockpit, and at that moment he was still alive. He passed immediately, but yes, he did land the airplane, and it was an Australian sharpshooter from the ground that actually got him. It wasn't from the air. It's a sharpshooter from Australia on the ground that killed Richthofen.
And I agree with that idea again. Well, that'll be one of those great ongoing controversies that'll go for the rest of mankind, probably. But it's an interesting story. The one thing we can tell you is pilots of the triplane, more than likely, if you let go of it, it's not going to fly straight, nor will it land itself. Some planes in World War One, there are instances where the pilot was killed and the plane continued to fly in a circle until it ran out of gas. So some of them are very stable, but they were more of the bomber-style aircraft or reconnaissance, and this is a fighter, and it's a true fighter.
It's kind of like the women who are putting their makeup on as they're going down the expressway. All right, we got some questions here. If you got a question, just raise your hand. I'll come with the microphone, and you can fire away. Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Rich. I flew an RB-7A from Malibu, California.
Good man.
And I think I'd really like to fly this, but my question is, the Germans are known for precision and engineering, and I've been curious about the wing that appears to have scallops designed in it. Did it have a function besides just looking interesting and nice and attractive?
I may defer this to Andrew, but correct me if I'm wrong here. But actually, I'll just give it to Andrew because there is a two-piece answer to that.
I only know one of the pieces, I guess, but the reason I think that they use, it's a wire trailing edge, and it scallops when the fabric tightens up on it, which is, of course, normal. But as far as I know, the main reason that they did that was just because it's light. They wanted everything to be as light as possible, so just a simple wire going across there instead of a piece of wood was the lightest thing they could do, and the scallops are just a coincidence of that.
Any other questions? Okay.
What's the second part?
It looks good. Is the second part? Okay.
There you go. I'm building one currently right now.
Just like this one?
Just like it.
All right.
I'm using a Redvern and Ron Sands plans.
Yep. This is a Ron Sands.
That's what I was going to ask, actually. What plans were this mostly based off of?
This is based on, there are two guys, Walt Redvern, whose triplane hangs at the EAA Museum here, and Ron Sands were two guys back in the 60s that were making plans available to the general public that replicated the Fokker triplane that were based on the original plans. And both of them have great designs or great replica plans. And so we owe a lot to them for today being able to have these aircraft.
My other question is, I know that this has a Lycoming. I saw it in Dayton.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what the video is based off of, flying to Dayton. But my other question is, I've got a Warner 165 going on mine. Why did they go with the Lycoming instead of a Warner?
Well, I think there's and Andrew might help me out on this too, but a couple reasons. One, a Warner 165 is a pretty valuable engine today. So it may be more difficult to attain. And the other thing is, for us in Colorado, we're at 5,000 feet at the ground level. So on a day like today when it's hot, we have density altitude real quickly, and it's nice for us to have 180 horsepower IO360 in here just for performance purposes. The Warner is a great engine in here. The nice thing about putting the Lycoming is that you can have the original Fokker cowl with the famous eyes. You can actually have the cooling capacity of it. You notice on the D8, which has a Continental 220, it's an opened-up cowl for cooling purposes.
Andrew was talking about the landing and how fast it'll slow down. Talk about takeoff, Andrew, the difficulty because you cannot see. From what I read, you better have a clear area or somebody better be looking for you. Accurate or no?
Well, yeah, there better not be anybody in front of you. And as Mark was saying, that's kind of the defining characteristic of it, is the middle wing basically with a tail down like this blocks out the whole entire world. And so not being able to see is really the hard part. It's unstable, you know, it's short coupled and all that kind of stuff. But if you could see out of it, that wouldn't be a problem. But so When you're coming down final, you can see great because the airplane's level, and we usually wheel land it, sometimes three-pointed, but usually wheel land it because you can get it on the ground and get it going good and straight, and you can kind of see where you're going and then let the tail down. And you can see there's little cutouts right next to the cockpit in the middle wing, and you can see a little bit out there enough to keep straight.
Is this typical for a tail drag? I mean, most tail draggers, you have a difficult time seeing. Is this more difficult
because of the tri-wing? Oh, this is far blinder than any other airplane I've ever flown or sat in or anything. Because, let's say, the wing goes from, you know, it's basically 180 degrees. It blocks out except for the little viewports on either side.
It's like having a Venetian blind in front of you. When you're flying, the blind's open. As soon as you put the tail down, the blind closes. You don't have any ability to see in front of you, really. And what you realize, in World War One, the pilots had the ability to land in fields, always into the wind for the most part, in a skid, which stopped them pretty quickly. So it was much more practical at that time. Today, Andrew, Mark, Bob, they have to land on a runway which may have a crosswind. And at our airport, we're about 42 feet wide, which in this plane, you have to stay with it and on the rudder at all time. And that's the trick. But it's a great design plane for its era.
Any other questions from anybody?
Hi, my name's Tim. I got a historical question I hope you guys can answer. The old rotary engine, the Lerones, used to bolt, the crankshaft bolted basically to the firewall, and the whole engine spun. I've heard, and I don't know for sure, the closest thing I got to this is a 6-foot RC model that I fly, and I know what you mean about it not being very stable. But if you could elaborate a little bit on the throttle, the carburetor, I mean, they used to click the magnetos on and off, and I mean, to get it to idle down, like landing, you hear them whoom, whoom, when they come in, and right. I don't think the carburation was really as far as idling and stuff, but I don't know if you can answer that or not.
Oh, yeah actually, I can. Actually, I have one of those rotary engines.
Speaking
I have
of a experience, yes, okay.
But, there's a lot of myths about the rotary engines also. The rotary engines were, there were some early ones were 7 cylinders. Most of them were 9 cylinders. There was actually an 11-cylinder late in the war. But the Fokker triplane and the Fokker D8, and if anybody has any questions about any of the other airplanes, too, ask away. But the rotary engine, that came about because in 1908, 1909, when people were first starting to build airplanes, they had trouble cooling the engines, there was a lot of liquid-cooled engines because that's what they knew from cars. But, of course, a liquid-cooled engine has a radiator and water jackets. It's a lot heavier than an air-cooled engine. And they had a problem cooling the air-cooled engine. So they took a radial engine, like a Warner or a 220, like is in the D8. They took a normal radial engine, and it was the Seguin brothers in France, I think, that came up with this idea. They thought, well, if we bolt the crankshaft stationary to the airplane and let the whole engine spin around and bolt the prop to that, it'll cool itself. It'll make its own cooling air. And that's the primary reason for the rotary engine. And, of course, nowadays you think about it, you kind of think they were nuts. But I've seen there's a motorcycle in a museum in Paris that has a rotary engine. And the engine bolts right to the rear wheel of the motorcycle and the whole engine and rear wheel spin. And I don't know how they stopped it, but... But that was the reason they came up with the rotaries. And so then they had a very good power-to-weight ratio. They were very light for the horsepower that they made. And there's a common, mostly a myth, that they either were full throttle or nothing at all. And that's a fairly common myth. The early Gnome engines were like that. The 100-horsepower Gnome engines were like that. But almost every rotary engine that flew in combat actually did have a carburetor on it. It was a slide valve carburetor that metered both the fuel and air. And they could throttle them down fairly low, but they didn't idle well. And so they could throttle them down to a certain extent. And they had what they called a blip button in England, or the French called it a coupé button. And I can't remember the German term for it, but it was just a button on the top of the control stick that did cut out the magnetos. And so if you were coming down final and your engine wasn't throttled down enough, you could cut it out. You're not supposed to use it at high power settings. Some people do, but it's hard on the engine. But basically, they could throttle up from about 1,350 RPM down to about 800 RPM, which was still enough to move the airplane. And there was two different kinds. The most common one was the Lerone, or the Germans, they copied it and called it the Oberursel. But they had two valves. This is a fake one here. But the Lerones and Oberursels had two valves. These big copper intake pipes on a real engine were the only way to get fuel and air to the engine. The crankshaft had to be hollow because everything was spinning around. And so the only way to get fuel and air in, you had intakes actually that stuck out back on the side of the fuselage. And the fuel and air went through the hollow crankshaft into the crankcase of the engine and then out to the cylinders through those copper pipes. And they used castor oil is a lubricating oil because it didn't tend to mix with the fuel, And so that's why you hear about the smell of the castor oil, and they burn castor oil. Well, the castor oil had to go in and go out with the fuel and air, too. Everything was one way. There was no recirculating stuff. And so when you see a rotary engine running, there'll be a big white cloud of castor oil. And I kind of like the smell. I kind of grew up around it at a place in New York called the old Rhinebeck Aerodrome, and where there was a lot of rotary engines. And I like the smell of burned castor oil. But the other myth is they talk about that it had a laxative effect on the pilots. And, of course, you know, that's a good story, I think, from the 1930s. But it really... You know, a lot of them, they flew two-hour missions sometimes, and if that was, I've never seen that mentioned in a memoir of a World War I pilot, never. So I think that's another one of those myths. And the other kind of a myth is the gyroscopic effect of it. Of course, you've got 300 pounds of engine spinning around on the front of the airplane, and it is going to have some kind of a gyroscopic effect. But again, the 30s pulp writers, I think, exaggerated that and talked about how they would turn twice as quick to the right as they would to the left. The actual fact of it was, in a gyroscope, if you know the gyroscopic precession, the reaction is at 90 degrees to the applied force. And so on a rotary engine airplane, when you turn right, the nose tries to go down, and when you turn left, the nose tries to come up. And obviously, if the nose is trying to go down, it's easier to get into a turn. And so they will turn better to the right than to the left, but it gets exaggerated in some of the writings that you hear about. And it's something, if it's, you know, if you've learned to fly in a modern Cessna, it'd take a lot to transfer to one of these.
You get your aerobics workout, don't you?
Right, yeah.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us. Andrew King, Andy Parks, Mark Holliday, and Bob, what's his face? Bob did all the talking this morning, as usual. Thank you, gentlemen, all for coming and enjoy your adventure, folks.